You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio, Sirius XM 111. Here again is Dan Loney.
Welcome back. Hour number two of our show, Knowledge at Wharton, here on Sirius XM 111, Business Radio powered by the Wharton School. Thanks very much for joining us. Tuesday, November the 17th. Great to have you with us, listening to us wherever you might be across the United States or up into Canada. Coming up here in the second hour of the show, free speech. It is a right given to all Americans, but with what is happening on college campuses right now, is free speech being taken advantage of? We'll talk about that coming up in just a second. And in about 30 minutes, we're going to look at the possible investment that Time Warner apparently wants to make in Hulu. And will it help them gain a larger share of consumers? So we've got that coming up for you in about 30 minutes. That here in the second hour, your comments are welcome at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio111 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. First, though, our number of the day. And the number of the day today is 50, as in $50, for those of you who are have kids and will be heading to the mall in your local town. You know, you take your kid to go sit on Santa's lap. Sometimes you want to get a picture with him. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you want to take that picture with your own smartphone. Sometimes you get that, you know, that package of pictures that they sell you when you're right there. Well, you know, you can either be for it or against it, but what has happened with a mall here in the Philadelphia area might be hitting a new low, because it is really taking the commercialization of Christmas to just a different level. Mall in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, has decided that having that mall Santa set up in most places now, before we even get to Thanksgiving, to take pictures with your kids running up to Christmas, needs to be more profitable. So that mall is charging visitors $35 to $50 a pop to sit on Santa's lap. You do get pictures with it, but the trick is that there's no option. It's not like you can go in, sit on Santa's lap, take the picture with your smartphone, and leave. If you want to sit on Santa's lap at the Cherry Hill Mall, you got to, well, I hate to use an old line, but you got to pay the piper in this case. So for people that live here in the Philadelphia area, and hopefully this is just not happening across the country, but for people that live in the Philadelphia area, going to the Cherry Hill Mall to take your kids to go see Santa Claus might not be the thing, if unless you don't want to have to pay the $50. The holiday spirit is in full bloom. The demonstrations that have taken place on a variety of college campuses lately, like Yale and Wesleyan, Ithaca College, and of course what happened at Missouri, slightly different, but in the same realm. But they're all bringing up the question of free speech and what is appropriate and what may be pushing the line. To look further at this issue, we're joined here in studio by Brian Berkey, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Legal Studies and Business Ethics here at the Wharton School, Carolyn Marvin, who's a professor of communication at Penn's Annenberg School of Communication, and also joining us, a Penn student, Alec Ward. He's a junior, and he's also a columnist at the Daily Pennsylvania newspaper here on campus. Great to have you all here. Thanks very much for coming in.
Great to be here. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much. I'll start with the side over here before I go to the student. But is there a loss of free speech on campuses right now?
Oh, I think over the years, every generation of students has to learn these lessons of free speech again and again and again, and the challenges come, you know, differently for different groups. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about right now. And I think students are actually responding to efforts to be censorious and beginning to appreciate and understand why it's such an important tradition at the university, in the society, but especially at the university.
Brian?
Yeah, so I think that's basically right. The students are sort of fighting for values that are extremely important, in particular racial injustice on campuses and in the broader society. They're concerned legitimately about these issues. But there have certainly been cases in which the students have sort of taken their criticisms of people who have simply said things that they disagreed with too far by calling for sort of sanctions actually to be raised. But I think many of the students have been responsive to some of these criticisms, and hopefully that will continue to be the case going forward.
Alec, what do you hear from students out here at on the University of Pennsylvania campus?
Well, there are certainly students here, in particular African-American students, who feel like they have been, on some level, denied access or denied the opportunity to be full and equal partners in the academic community. And I think that's a really important grievance, and it's important that we hear that. But what I, as someone who really believes in the academic and social value of free speech, am concerned about is that a lot of the reasons they cite for feeling like they're being denied partnership have to do with things that people have said, whether it's expressing opinions or making jokes, or we had a little kerfuffle over a over a Christmas card last year that included a caricaturish African-American, I'll call it a mannequin. And so I wonder whether the fact that people seem to believe that things that people say have such power to deprive them of something valuable means that either we don't really understand how the marketplace of ideas fully can function, because I personally think that, you know, especially in the academic realm, everything that someone says is an opportunity for learning and for dialogue, and it's not so much a weapon as I think sometimes people portray it as.
A lot of people will look at what has happened at the University of Missouri in the last week or so and focus on that because of the fact that it really started off by one individual saying, look, we need to have a change in our university, deciding to go on a hunger strike, and realistically getting not much response at all. And it wasn't until the football team actually got into this that we actually had any real movement on it. And actually, I think we got a ton more publicity about it once the football team kind of got involved in it. And in some respects, that's a little disappointing to me that it took that kind of effort, the football team to be involved in it, to actually get any kind of movement on this. You agree?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what that reveals to some extent is that the students are right to feel like they have not really been heard by the administrations that they've been trying to engage with on these issues. It did take the football team threatening, or many members of the football team, you know, committing to not practice and not play, which, of course, you know, if they followed through with this, would have cost the university $1 million per game to, you know, as a result of forfeiting and the sort of contractual agreements that they have. And it shouldn't take something like that, something that threatens to cost the university a whole lot of money, to get the administration to take seriously the very legitimate concerns that these students have.
You know, I think that reminds me of the most successful transformative social movement against racial injustice that we've ever had in this country, which is the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the case of Rosa Parks, the bus boycotts that era prosecuted so successfully was somewhat similar in that the bus boycotts, where it hurt, was in the city coffers. And so, you know, there was a concerted action to have that consequence. But that's also a really important reminder that that movement all the way through capitalized on the First Amendment and its right to speak unpopular truths to the democracy. And that if that unpopular speech at that time, and this that was a much different situation than we're facing now, even though we need to do lots of stuff still, without the protection of freedom of expression, it would have been very difficult for that movement to go forward. And I think that's something, that kind of ability to transform the populace on the basis of persuasion and civil disobedience is something that our students hopefully will, you know, remember and take strength from.
But it has to be extremely disappointing, the fact that that a financial element has to be involved in it to really get some sort of change kind of affected, at least in these couple of cases.
I don't think it's always the case that
it
takes,
exactly.
You know, and I think it takes different kinds of actions in different places. And people, you know, look at their situation and they try to think what to do.
Yeah.
But they didn't stop speech. You know,
yeah.
They decided they wouldn't play, and
yeah.
you know, but they kept talking, and it's keeping talking that allows us to evaluate and think about what's going on.
But I think there is a connection between the way that the University of Missouri reasoned in this case and sort of the larger reason why we're seeing a backlash on campus to uncomfortable ideas. This is the university thinking like a business. This is the ultimate sort of lesson. Dick Meyer over at Scripps, he's a bureau chief for DC, he said it's the ultimate lesson in Machiavellianism. When you want something to change, you hit them where it hurts, and where it hurts is their wallet. And it's, I think, that we're seeing universities thinking like businesses has something to do with why students are getting so upset about these things, because they haven't been told that this is a place where you're going to come and potentially be confronted, be uncomfortable, be offended, and learn from it. They've been told this is a place where we want to, you know, make you comfortable. We want to give you a home.
Sure.
And the student at Yale said, it's not about creating an intellectual space. It's about creating a home. And the reason I think universities have done that has to do with the marketplace, has to do with thinking like a business, competition. You know, there became this Olympics of who can have the most comfortable dorms, the best food, the, and how to sell yourself to potential students like that. And so as we see universities thinking like businesses on that front, we see them thinking like businesses on other fronts and responding instead of to principled arguments to potential financial loss, and I think that's a problem.
But it is a unique aspect, and I agree that a lot of the universities are thinking from a business perspective, and it makes me wonder that a lot of this is coming down on the presidents of the university. Obviously, it did with the University of Missouri, but also some of this needs to come down on the board of the particular schools as well, because those are the people that realistically are the ones that think more like a business than anybody else in that university. The president of the university is supposed to think more like a professor, correct? Am I right about that?
Right, and I think they're to some extent reaping what they sowed today, because they backed away from thinking like principled institutions. They backed away from thinking like places more like churches than like businesses, almost places that had a bedrock set of ideas about what was good, that open discourse was good, that free speech was good, but they started thinking more in terms of satisfying customers.
Yeah.
And customers don't always want the same things that the institution's principles mandate we should have.
Brian?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of the source of the problem lies in the way that universities have been operating, as Alec was suggesting. I mean, you see, Tim Wolf at Missouri, before he became president of the University of Missouri system, was a businessman. He had no experience in higher education. And so it's not surprising that as president, he was sort of operating in the way that he was used to operating in a business context. And that, I think, you know, is not necessarily the appropriate model for a university system and for somebody, you know, functioning as a university president as opposed to a CEO. The flip side of universities operating in this way is that students start and parents start to think of themselves as customers rather than as people who are, you know, showing up to an institution of higher learning where they're going to be challenged and where they're going to be confronted by ideas that might make them uncomfortable and might challenge them in ways that they, you know, that they don't necessarily want to be challenged.
So then are we talking about realistically a seed shift that needs to change within universities? I mean, it may not be, I don't want to put it as a broad brush because there are probably, you know, different levels at different universities, but seemingly some of the ideas and concepts that universities are thinking in terms of how they should run on a day-to-day operation need to change. Obviously, it's a very difficult environment for all universities right now trying to make sure that they stay profitable.
Right, and there is a market. You know, higher ed has, because of the role it plays socially, you know, it is now this this rite of passage for a huge swath of American society and potentially going to be an even bigger one as we try to make it more accessible. It's no longer a specialty good, and that changes the nature of what you have to offer to be competitive, because you're not necessarily just targeting a portion of people who are really deeply committed to academics. You're targeting people who want different kinds of things out of it. They want a credential. They want a maturation experience. They want a a sort of a fun 4-year transition to adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And academic integrity in the broad sense is not really essential to many of those other types of things that people are demanding.
But I think it's important not to romanticize the history of the university. It's not as though once upon a time everybody that came to university was only interested in academic principles and intellectual space and all the rest of it. These are challenges the university has faced before. I'm thinking of speech codes, which were basically the mm-hmm. way that this same controversy played out at an earlier point a decade or so ago. And I'm thinking of loyalty oaths, which followed World War II and the communist scare in the United States. But I also think it's heartening, it's important to to talk about those universities who have responded in a positive way. I mean, Yale has a really long and distinguished tradition of defending freedom of expression, and they affirmed their commitment to expression and had a march for open expression and the importance of pursuing debate. So it can be done. Another piece of this that sort of was part of the prelude to what's happening now is the last couple of years, the disinviting or protesting of commencement speakers who have been selected by duly constituted committees. And I think that's a very disturbing thing as well. And so I think there's numerous I don't think challenges ever go away. And, what we have to do is continue to reaffirm exactly the principles that Alec is talking about and to make clear that, and to talk to everybody has to talk about that, the administrators, the faculty, mm-hmm. the students. It's an ongoing conversation. And, what we don't want is a zero-sum annihilation of the opponent, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I think we have to live with people who disagree with us and work it out. And I think this was also a great strength of the civil rights movement. They never tried to annihilate the opponent. They understood the importance of free speech. They presented their case, and they allowed the other side to present its case. And people saw that conflict, and they made their judgments, and great progress was made at that time.
So then do you think, Carolyn, do we have an opportunity here, let's say over the next few years, to really try and change this dynamic and in some respects tear down the wall that has been built up between universities and students in some cases to make that conversation, that speech go a little bit easier and for both sides to understand what each is trying to bring to the table?
I'm not sure we can ever make the conversation go easier.
Okay.
I think what we can do is we can bring ideas about the importance of having the conversation.
Okay.
And I don't think we should say, let's have the conversation and then we'll punish you if you say something that I don't agree with. That's going to be a very mixed message and problematic. Majorities are also always trying to control the speech of minorities. And majorities, who's a majority and who's a minority, move around a lot. And so it's the commitment to the conversation that is so important.
Go ahead.
There are, I think, some tropes that have been introduced into the conversation that universities need to publicly back away from. There is a notion floating around that speech can be violence. That expressing a intensely dissenting opinion can be akin somehow to an act of physical aggression. I think universities need to renounce that. Need to renounce that. Speech is somehow more than speech in a number of ways. And I think that's part of reaffirming these values.
So then is that part of what the universities see as not that it's a valid concern, but maybe it is a concern in their mind somehow that speech will lead to violence in some manner?
Well, saying that speech can lead to violence and saying that speech is violence are very different kinds.
Yes.
And it would be silly to try to assert that speech can't lead to violence. There are a very clear set of legal precedents on this. I believe the relevant one here is Brandenburg versus Ohio, which was a case of a Klansman who was arrested for inciting violence, essentially. And what the court said was speech can incite imminent lawless action, and that kind of speech can be punished. But that's not what we're talking about when we're having these kinds of conversations about aggressive speech or.
But in Brandenburg, what was important was that the speech was not seen by the court to lead to violence.
People right, Brandenburg to, himself, yeah. But they acknowledged that speech yes, could course, be an yeah. incitement to imminent
but
lawless action.
But that wasn't an example of it. And so it right. the standard that you articulated, what actually constitutes a threat, is that which leads immediately to imminent lawless violence.
Right.
And that simply disagreeable speech, unpopular speech, uncomfortable speech is not that standard.
Right. And I see no reason why universities can't hold up the Brandenburg test as a sort of the way that a sane society committed to open expression deals with these kinds of issues. And I think many universities, the majority, have codes of conduct which go far beyond the limits set in Brandenburg toward the kind of speech that they will punish, and including public universities, and then their state actors, that becomes a real legal First Amendment issue.
844-WHARTON is the number if you'd like to jump in the conversation and add a comment on your behalf. 844-942-7866. Here in the studio, we're joined by Brian Berkey of the Wharton School, assistant professor in legal studies and business ethics, Carolyn Marvin from Penn's Annenberg School of Communication, a professor there, and Alec Ward, who is a junior here at the University of Pennsylvania and a columnist with the Daily Pennsylvanian. Again, 844-WHARTON is the number if you'd like to jump in. 844-942-7866. I guess in some respects, when you think about universities today and their goal in terms of trying to basically teach and get students ready for their next part of their life, it does make you wonder that they don't have a closer relationship on a lot of these issues, that there is kind of that disconnect between the two, especially here in 2015, since, as you said, we've come so far since the days of the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, they're students.
True.
And so that means that, we're here at the university to help them move through some of these issues. So I'm not surprised that not all students understand, as Alec does, the depth of these kinds of values and the importance of them. And that's what education is for, exactly that. So universities have to commit to that and deliver the necessary education and engage students.
Yeah.
And, it is the students, my trope that I am concerned about is the question of safe spaces.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we want students to have safe spaces from violence and intimidation and all the rest of it. But there's a kind of infantilizing that goes along with the connotation of that statement. And I think, again, the model of the civil rights movement is so powerful for students, I think. And those people didn't retreat into a sheltered space. They went out and engaged the world, and they became resilient and empowered as a result of that. And that's what I want for our students, for them to be resilient and empowered yeah. from facing the world and engaging with it.
How much has this topic specifically come up in the classes that you've been teaching within the last couple of weeks?
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
I make it my business
yeah,
to make
absolutely.
Sure that the things that the students are hearing about and reading about and participating in become topics for reflection and analytic discussion in class. I think they're very important. We are educating citizens. These are topics that engage citizens,
yeah.
and I want those topics to be discussed by students so that we can think reflectively about them in the kind of atmosphere that's possible in a college classroom.
And what are the majority of the comments that you get from the students about these specific, like Missouri specifically? Mm-hmm. What were the reactions that you were getting?
Well, I think students have a tendency, because they're students, to side in the first instance with the students who are like them. And students are so sincerely, or at least the ones that I think we have, and in generally, they oppose racial injustice.
Sure.
And I think that's a wonderful thing. And so the question is, what is the way to advance the cause of racial justice most effectively? Is it to regulate those who may not agree with us, or is it to try to persuade each other and learn from each other? Yeah. So we work through that in a very specific way.
Yeah, I think that last point is one of the most important ones that can be made in this debate, is that it's not actually going to be effective in the fight for racial justice to simply have policies that silence those who would in fact speak in a way that is offensive and objectionable. Right. What we need is robust engagement with people to change their minds, right? And students who are involved in the fight for racial justice need to be able to engage in a serious way, to make arguments, to be persuasive, to confront people with whom they disagree. And that's how the civil rights movement is a great example. Again, that's one of the most important ways that progress can be made. It won't actually do much good to have a whole bunch of people who are racially insensitive on campus who are simply afraid to say the objectionable things that they believe.
Alec? Right?
Yeah, I mean, I've had this conversation with some of the activist groups on campus who have at various times called for expression they didn't like to be punished. I said, you're the last people who should want this. It would be a very odd lesson to have learned from American history to think that if we grant the authorities the power to deem certain opinions outside of what our commitments protect, to think it will never be used against the marginalized and only ever in their aid, I think is a kind of dangerous delusion.
Right. 844 Wharton is the number if you'd like to jump in and have a quick comment. We have a couple more minutes with our guests, Brian Berkery of the Wharton School, Carolyn Marvin of the Penn's Annenberg School, and Alec Ward of the Daily Pennsylvania, and also Junior here. Carolyn, you want to say something?
I also want to say that it's a question of the legitimacy of democracy. In a democracy, we have majority rule, and if we want minorities to follow what the majority decides, we absolutely must allow them the space and time to say their piece. So I think, you know, free speech is part of establishing the legitimacy of democracy, democratic rule itself.
We have a comment coming in from Montclair, New Jersey. Arjorie, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
I enjoyed your discussion so far, and I'm just wondering, it made me think about myself and being yelled at just so violently by somebody that it actually felt violent to me, the actual, like, the speech that was coming at me. And I'm wondering where that line is between, so he wasn't necessarily, it wasn't inciting violence, what he said. I wasn't worried about that, although I guess I could have gotten that far. But it was just the speech itself was just so vile that I actually felt assaulted physically.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering about where that line, you know, where that comes into the discussion.
Yeah, so I think there can certainly be forms of speech that can sort of feel roughly like violence. In many cases, though, on the campuses, I don't think the things that the students have sometimes objected to fall into that category, right? So if you're being yelled at, screamed at, right, that's one thing, right? If somebody is simply expressing a viewpoint with which you disagree, right, that's another. And I think Alec was sort of suggesting earlier that we need to be able to draw these distinctions in a sort of careful and thoughtful way. And certainly there are grounds for condemning, morally speaking, forms of speech that can come across at least somewhat like violence. Mm-hmm. In a way that there aren't grounds for condemning speech that merely expresses a viewpoint that some people find problematic or offensive or whatever it
but
might
from
be.
A legal perspective, I think it's very hard to draw the kind of line
that
you're asking about, because the reason we criminalize violence is that it actually does prevent you from exercising some of your rights. If I hit you, if I assault you in some physical way, you're unable potentially and likely unable to respond in an equal way.
Sure.
Whereas speech that feels like violence, and I know it might sound a little cold-hearted to say this, but it's not violence. I haven't actually taken away any of your rights if I've screamed at you. I may have deeply upset you, and that may be of moral significance, but it simply doesn't rise to the consequential outcomes that physical violence does. And I think what we're concerned with when we're criminalizing physical violence are the consequences of an assault, of a battery. And the consequences are not the same as someone screaming at you.
Yeah. Harlan?
I think freedom is for the brave. And I think there is a cost to freedom of expression in a democracy. And some of it is being deeply, deeply uncomfortable. There are certainly also situations, for example, in parliamentary debates and so on, where people are limited by the amount of time that they can offer and things like that. So we have situations in which there are very, very specific situations in which we might think of ways to limit speech. And so I don't want to, if somebody's being yelled at, there are circumstances in which that would be considered a threat. And it's very, very dependent on the individual circumstances. And there's that. But nobody in a democracy can give up the responsibility in some sense, and we cannot allow the responsibility to be given up, that we must live with the people who really don't like us and that we really don't like, and find some way to be together in the society without banishing them.
Audrey, let me ask you a quick question. When this happened to you, was this a male that was basically accosting you with language at this point?
You know, it was a cousin of mine that was actually over some property inheritance that we have in another country. But it was just beyond. It was so vile and I almost felt physically assaulted. So I got to think about, you know, it wasn't even a discussion. It wasn't, it'd been nice to be able to discuss it, but it was just like a barrage of like just attack language. So I got thinking about that for myself and where that also comes into play, like out in college campuses or out in public.
Exactly. Thank you very much for calling in and adding to the show. I have to end it there, unfortunately. Thank you very much all for coming in, and hopefully maybe we could do this again sometime. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Great to have you all here. Brian Berkery from the Wharton School, Carolyn Marvin from Penn Zandenberg School, and Alec Ward, who is a student here and also a columnist at the Daily Pennsylvanian. Take a break. Back with more of the show in just a minute. You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton on Sirius XM 111, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.